Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Anne Mullen. She'll be telling us about recent accessibility happenings at the University of Windsor. So tell me a little bit about recent accessibility happenings here at the U.
Well, we're in full swing of our 2014-2015 academic year, and we have a number of accessibility committees on campus that have been working on some initiatives. One of particular interest is an awareness campaign that our Accessible Education Training and Awareness Committee has undertaken. And what we're really looking at doing is creating a number of short pieces around barriers that persons with disabilities might experience on campus and what the campus community can do to either eliminate those barriers or reduce them. So we're really trying to frame it around anecdotal pieces where somebody might be creating a barrier and not be aware of it, but when they do that certain thing, here is the impact. And I'll give you an example. We have a student on that committee who is blind, and he uses a screen reader in order to access all of his electronic information. Well, currently, the Xerox machines on campus, if you physically take a printed sheet of paper and you feed it into the machine to scan it and turn it into an electronic copy, the screen readers don't pick that up. So what we're trying to do is create the awareness that, look at, you might not even be aware that you're creating this barrier, but it happens. So if you're going to be converting a document to an electronic document, if you could actually do it through the computer and the software, it won't create that barrier. So really getting people to understand from the perspective of the person who's experiencing the barrier, what happens when you do things that you might not be aware of that create problems.
What would you say are some of the most common barriers?
Attitudinal barriers, where, and I say attitudinal barriers and the lack of awareness or understanding. And I'm guilty of this as much as the next person. If you haven't lived an experience of a certain barrier in your life, then you might not be aware of it. So it's really getting the message out there that here's something that you might not be aware of that you're doing, and if you do it a certain way or if you don't do it at all, then you won't create that problem. So it's all about understanding the different perspectives and the perspectives of persons with different disabilities, because disability is so dynamic and different, and each person's experience is different than the other person's, other people, that just getting that understanding.
So, what are some of the policies here at the U in regards to what should be in place accessibility-wise?
Well, we have an accessibility policy. It's online, and if anybody wants to get a copy in an alternate format, they can contact my office. We're the Office of Human Rights, Equity, and Accessibility, and you can call the university directly, 519-253-3000, to get in touch with us. But the accessibility policy talks about all of the measures that we're putting in place to create a more accessible campus, and also what we're doing to ensure we're meeting our responsibilities under the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. We also have an annual accessibility plan and a report as well that we draft. And the report speaks to all of the achievements that we've made over the past year and the past few years. And the plan speaks to what we're going to be doing in the future. And so we've made it, it's a multi-year plan. So looking at, okay, what are some of the short-term projects or goals that we're going to be working on? And what are some of the projects that are going to take a few years, but these are things that need to get done, and it might take us a bit of time to complete that. So we have that. And then also there's the whole piece around accommodation. So for students, we have the student accommodation policy, which is managed out of our student disability services. But we also have 3,000 to 4,000 employees here on campus. So we have accommodation responsibilities to our employees as well. And that is something that our Accessible Employment Committee is currently working on, is updating our accommodation guidelines for employees, just to make sure that the roles and responsibilities are clearly spelled out in there, and to make it a document that's useful for both employees, supervisors, and the entire university community.
So in your time working in accessibility here at the U, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
Well, I think one of the big challenges is working in a large institution. They're in different areas doing different things. So trying to coordinate projects that need to happen can be challenging, and also trying to get the correct people together to work on those projects. Time is another issue. I mean, we're all strapped for time. I think that's just the reality of the world that we live in. So trying to set aside the time we need to work on some projects. And one piece, I guess, would be the turnover with students. I mean, for undergrads, they're here for 4 years and then they're gone. And, you know, you get getting involved with some students who are just phenomenal and they have great ideas, great energy. We're working on projects and then they're not here anymore. And so one of the things that we try to work on is continuity amongst groups, so that we'll have students that may be in first year, second year, and then students in third, fourth year. So we won't lose that knowledge as students graduate and move on to the next stages in their lives.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with accessibility coordinating, is there any one success that stands out for you?
Oh, there's so many successes. And I think, again, it's going back to that coordinated effort and looking at, we have many, many people on campus who, although accessibility is a shared responsibility, it's not part of their core job, but it's something that is very important to them and they've been working towards. I'll give you an example. Next week, Tuesday, December 10th, we're having the first annual Office of Human Rights, Equity, and Accessibility Awards. It's going to be from 12 noon to 2 o'clock in the Odette Building, Room 123, open to anybody that wants to attend. But we're giving the first accessibility award to a gentleman named Richard Damala. Richard recently retired from the university, and by recently I mean last week, so we just lost him. But for the past 10 years, Richard, he works in web development, and he's not only been working to educate the entire university community about what makes a website accessible. As the university's been building out new websites over the past few years, he has been on top of making sure that what is being built out is being built to the highest possible standards. So for persons who are using screen readers or any other assistive technology, it doesn't create the barriers to them, and it makes it that much more accessible. But for many people, they don't even know this is happening in the background. But Richard has felt that this is incredibly important. So, you know, it just having that commitment and building something out from the beginning that has accessibility built into it has been excellent. And the other thing, too, is a lot of the building that's going up around campus, like we have the Welcome Center and we have the buildings that are going up downtown. The architects and the project managers, they've not only been engaging my office in the discussion, but also our Accessible Built Environment Committee. And I think that's really important, because there's a lot of pieces that might get missed if we weren't part of the discussion about catching some issues that might come up. I mean, you know, in discussions, we're looking at things like acoustics in the ceiling and what's the impact on somebody who's using a hearing aid, to how much glass is going to be in the area, and persons who might have vision or light sensitivities with their vision, how is this going to impact them? Do we have adequate shades? You know, making sure that we catch as many pieces as possible so that when we're moving forward with new websites, new buildings, new things on campus, it's set up being accessible and we don't have to go backwards and, you know, retrofit. It's more costly and more time consuming. So, yeah, I guess to kind of go back to your original question there, it's for me, it's been wonderful working with so many people on campus that, like I say, it's not part of their core job, but for them, they have a commitment to accessibility and they spend the time and the energy and resources to help work towards a more accessible campus.
So you were telling me earlier about Accessibility Awareness Day.
Yes, we're really excited. This is our third annual Accessibility Awareness Day here at U Windsor. The event is going to be held Wednesday, March 18th. It's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the CAW Student Center. And one of the things that's been very important to us is keeping the day free of charge to everybody. So that's the goal of this year, is to have it free of charge. There'll be a free lunch for those who register. And the theme for this year is accessible recreation. We've been able to secure Luca Lazy Legs Patuali as our keynote speaker. And for persons who may not be familiar with him, he has been on The Ellen Show. He's been on NBC Today. He was on Canada's So You Think You Can Dance. And he's a break dancer who uses two crutches. And what the powerful message that he's bringing to our group is that not only a message of no excuses, anybody with any type of ability can do anything, but changing the way that people perceive assistive devices. So he looks at his crutches as an extension of his movement in the same way that a ballerina uses their shoes as an extension of their movement. And I think that's really powerful in changing the way that we perceive, again, the disability and assistive devices. So we're really excited to have him as the keynote speaker. There's going to be three streams of sessions for the remainder of the day. One stream will be geared towards students, another to staff and faculty, and another to the broader community. So we really want to have that community building happening here, sharing ideas, and having a day where everybody can come together and hopefully learn something new. So we welcome folks to come out and check out our website. It's www.uwindsor.ca/AAD2015, so AAD 2015.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Ontario Students Against Impaired Driving is an anti-impaired driving initiative that strives to promote smart, healthy choices through education and public awareness to prevent tragedies caused by impaired and distracted driving. OSAID is about teens helping teens to consider safe alternatives and new perspectives to the perceived norms about alcohol, illicit drugs, and dangerous driving. For more information or to join the team, visit www.osaid.org.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Anne Mullen. She gave us an overview of the University of Windsor's latest disability initiatives. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Raymond Marco. He'll be telling us about his organization's latest efforts in regards to tuberous sclerosis. Tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with TSC.
Well, it's been a pretty exciting time, Cam. We've had a recent conference, a research conference in China, and of course everyone knows how huge China is for population, but their TS Association in China is basically just getting started, but they're getting started in a big way. And there were clinicians from around the world in Beijing to discuss research and to discuss behavior problems and pretty much the whole gamut of difficulties that happen with tuberous sclerosis complex. That was a wonderful conference, and just before that we had one in Washington, D.C. in July, and that was sponsored by the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance from the United States. And once again, there was 1,100 participants there over 4 days, and terrific news on many fronts that we're making progress in research into disease. Actually, outside of tuberous sclerosis, the TSC research, it's called a linchpin disease now, tuberous sclerosis, because it plays into cancer research, multiple sclerosis, kidney disease, cystic fibrosis, psychiatry. So it's what we're doing with tuberous sclerosis is really affecting the whole research community, and this is a great thing because we get cooperation from so many more organizations with the research that's going on for tuberous sclerosis.
So you mentioned the Beijing Association is relatively new.
Oh, it is, yes.
Are you going to be working in partnership with them?
Basically, we have an organization called the Tuberous Sclerosis Complex International. So that's the body that brings all the associations like Tuberous Sclerosis Canada into a partnership. And when there's a conference, the Tuberous Sclerosis International has a meeting along with the conferences at the same time. And this gets everyone together. And then, of course, through various electronic and social media, the members of the Tuberous Sclerosis International are also meeting and discussing things, too. So this is wonderful that research is not in these silos anymore. You know, say findings are in one country and it doesn't really get out to other countries. Now, the information is shared around the world, and so, you know, we don't reinvent the wheel. We keep moving forward. This is really, I think, terrific progress.
So what are the next steps for Tuberous Sclerosis Canada?
Well, we have a new surgeon and clinic on board now in Hamilton, and being in Windsor, you may have some listeners there who would be quite interested in this. Dr. Anil Kapoor is a surgeon at McMaster University, and he now has a tuberous sclerosis clinic that he's working on there. And there's a meeting on Monday, February the 9th, at the Jurabansky Cancer Center Theater at the Hamilton Health Sciences Center, and that goes from 7 to 9 p.m. And anyone who has, what would you say, a patient or a family member of a patient or someone who's just interested could come out to this session with Dr. Kapoor. There is a flyer for that on the Tuberous Sclerosis Canada website, and that explains everything, and it's a lot easier to perhaps look that up on the internet than it would be to go into it in detail right now. But we're so happy to have Dr. Kapoor join our efforts to spread awareness and also to help families in the Niagara-Hamilton region.
So have there been any recent challenges in regards to the work that is going on for tuberous sclerosis?
Well, I think there have been ethical challenges, Cam. Things that are being suggested now are wholesale newborn screening. That's not just for tuberous sclerosis complex, but for a whole gamut of possible hereditary diseases. And with the newborn screening, we may be able to catch some people, you know, young infants who would normally maybe have neurological problems later, but we could catch them early. But it presents ethical issues about, you know, how we, I guess, interfere or intercede with families and their personal decisions. One of the big things, I think this is something that's really come to the fore, is the damage that these seizures that are called infantile spasms cause. Infantile spasms almost sounds like it's not very important, or, you know, like it's a minor thing, but at the latest conference that I went to in Washington, these are called catastrophic seizure events in that they do so much cognitive damage to the infant, and quite often these are not caught until the child has had significant cognitive damage. And that's really for a lifetime. These deficits are never recovered. And so because of that cognitive loss, society pays a very high price in quite often helping these people through the healthcare system. It becomes very expensive. If we could stop the infantile spasms early on, recognize them like pediatricians or family doctors could recognize them sooner and get help. Help is in the drugs that can actually stop these infantile spasms, and then we would have perhaps a lot less trouble with behavior and with medical problems that happen later with children with tuberous sclerosis complex.
So if you could send any one message about the importance of the screening and your thoughts on it, what would it be?
Well, my thoughts are that this screening could be so valuable for affecting these hereditary diseases and perhaps getting help for families before, you know, there's a catastrophe like they have a beautiful baby, but then find out within a couple of months that there's something seriously wrong. With the newborn screening, my feeling is that this would be great for getting a baby's a help before something comes up later on. So I realize there are religious beliefs and there are ethical issues sometimes with interfering with prenatal or newborns. But to me, as a humanitarian, I think this is what we should do, is we should be looking for things. And wouldn't parents all love to have like a more or less a clean bill of health saying, you know, that more things have been checked other than just, you know, that the baby has five fingers on each hand and five toes on each foot and stuff like that? You know, that maybe they're clear of hereditary diseases, or that they could get attention for something right away. Instead of waiting and finding it out like a trauma later on. So that would be my ultimate message on newborn screening.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
When it comes to something like screening, my thoughts are it's generally a good thing. So many things can be detected, prevented, treated these days. The cost in life, long-term potential of a person in this world, cannot be measured in a financial sense. However, that being said, there are some religious circumstances that prevent invasive medical procedures. However, if there's a way to balance it, if there's a way to screen without doing anything that invasive, I'd say my own thoughts are, it's worth the effort. It's worth taking the time to support a person just as they enter this world. No one has any idea what can be achieved by any one individual. But, like anyone in society, each of us has skills, hopes, dreams, all our own. My personal thinking is, each of us should be given the potential, the opportunity to explore what we're capable of at our best. And that's what screening's all about in my eyes. It's interesting, the two interviews today, looking at the beginning of life to the long-term progression when a person is college or university age, seeing that things are in place for children, young adults, even seniors these days. Why in the world should we not take every step possible to be there for young ones as they enter the world? Whether they have a disability or not, it's our responsibility as a society to stand beside them and say, I want to help you succeed. I want to see if you can be that someone who changes the world. Growing up with a disability, I've come to understand there are a lot of support systems. Fact is, It's really a tragedy more people don't know what can be done. There are answers out there. Individuals who understand the issues surrounding any given condition. And working together with others, progress is made. That's why I was very pleased to hear during Raymond's interview that Tuberous Sclerosis International is branching out even farther, taking more and more steps within the global community just to see what can be accomplished. He was right, there is no sense in reinventing the wheel every time. If all these organizations are aware of the progress that each one makes, perhaps it can be combined. Perhaps they might even make real progress. It is all about communication, folks. Asking the questions in disability life. What does this really mean? Then again, what something might mean on paper, the potential that a condition has, doesn't factor in the human element. A person with a disability, in addition to hopes, dreams, and talents, they also have strengths all their own. You always hear of those cases where someone has a 1% chance to survive, and they live another 20 years. That, my dear friends, is an example of the strength and the character a person with a disability must find. I maintain that a person is truly free to live in their greatest way possible when they're not ruled by their condition, when they don't make it the all-defining aspect of who they are. Is it critical? Yes. Is it a part of who they are? Yes. May it impact certain things in social situations and job situations? Yes. But does it have to be something that prevents you from taking a chance, taking a step forward? Does it have to be something that says, I didn't succeed at this job application because of my condition? No, it doesn't have to be so. It can be, I didn't get there this time, but knowing my skills, knowing my strengths, I'm going to look and I'm going to try to find what I can do. And when I do, I will excel at it. Person with a disability, many times for them it's just knowing what needs to be done and finding a way to do it, finding an adaptation that makes something possible. May take time, may take patience, but I maintain the more steps we take, no matter what the condition, the better we will be as a society. Because individuals with disabilities are simply part of the tapestry. They're part of the makeup of all that we as a society are. You can't say society is complete if any given group is not allowed to be considered as part of it. Individuals with disabilities, like any other group, they're really taking steps forward. More and more people are noticing that disability life is not a limitation. That is not its defining characteristic. What is its defining characteristic is strength and wisdom. Strength to be out there living in a way that makes a person feel that satisfaction we're all looking for, and the wisdom to know that disability is one part of a person's life, but not the totality. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks, and we'll see you next week.